Gone South has been a podcast about crime in the American South. But for our new season, we're widening the lens. Follow and listen to Gone South Season 5, wherever you get your shows.
Welcome to Face Connecticut, an in-depth look at today's issues.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Face Connecticut. I'm Morgan Cunningham on WTIC News Talk 1080, Light 100.5 WRCH, and 96.5 TIC. Our guest this morning is Dr. Eric Jackson. He is the executive director of the Connecticut Transportation Institute, and he is based out of the University of Connecticut. And we're excited to have him on the show this morning because we have to talk about a very serious issue that's been going on in Connecticut, and that is the issue of wrong-way drivers. In fact, just this past week alone, there have been three incidents in which there were non-fatal crashes that ended in arrests stemming from wrong-way drivers. Now, much of what we're going to talk about this morning are crashes that have ended in fatalities, but certainly a lot to talk about, so let's get underway. Eric, welcome to the program. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Let's just start off with some general information about what you guys do at the Institute and how you do it. If you could explain that, please.
Absolutely. So we work very closely with the Connecticut Department of Transportation. We compile motor vehicle crashes across the entire state. So every crash that occurs that a police report is generated for, we actually compile all of that data and put it up on a website that allows people to come in and query that data. And then we do analysis for the Connecticut DOT. So we track trends that are going on. We look at spatial distributions. We really try and support the Connecticut DOT in decisions they need to make regarding traffic safety.
Could you talk a little bit about the process that goes into analyzing the data from the point in which you get the information from the police report to the data that you're able to compile for the website and for people like me? You sent me some great charts and graphs. So what goes into that work?
So when a crash report comes in, we have a group of crash coders here at the university. They actually open every crash. They make sure the data quality is accurate. They add the route and milepost to make sure that we're being as accurate as possible with those reports. And then we publish that up to a website that allows the general public to come in. They can create graphs, charts, even maps of the entire state or even down to individual roadways. And then we also produce a dashboard of 26 different emphasis areas. So we take that data, we distill it down into things like bicycles or pedestrians or commercial vehicle crashes or motorcycle crashes. And we distill it down into bite-sized chunks that's easy to quickly look at and see some of the trends that are going on. So our goal is really to support, within a quick look, anybody that's interested in traffic safety, you can quickly go in and figure out what's going on and see where things are trending. And the past trends we're seeing ever since the COVID lockdown took place, we've gone from a decrease in a lot of our trends to dramatic increases in whether it's injuries or fatalities or just number of crashes.
And people might be wondering in general where they can find this information online. Do you have a link for them to go to?
Absolutely. So our website is ctcrash.ucon.edu. So connecticutcrash.ucon.edu. The site's pretty much open to the public. There is one spot where you have to register to use, but it's nearly instant to register. And then you have access to basically all the data and facts and charts, minus any personal and private information, so we scrubbed that out. But you can basically see crash data that goes back to 1995, so we have over 30 years' worth of crash data.
Wow, that's a lot of data.
Absolutely. So when we're looking at these trends, we're really trying to understand trends over time. So a lot of times I get a lot of questions about impaired driving and how the legalization of cannabis affects things. So a lot of those things we have to look back over a much larger period.
Let's talk about wrong-way crashes specifically. That is the catalyst for our conversation this morning, my chat with Dr. Eric Jackson of the Connecticut Transportation Institute at UConn. He's the executive director of the group. Let's just talk a little bit in general about wrong-way crashes, because this is one area that you have been seeing a lot of in your research, as you mentioned, since the COVID pandemic.
Absolutely. So prior to the COVID pandemic, we would see maybe 5 to 6 wrong-way driving fatal crashes that would occur throughout the state. In 2022, we had one of our worst years ever, where we had 13 wrong-way driver fatal crashes that resulted in 23 fatalities. So, you know, 2 to 3 times typically what we would see. In 2023, we had a little bit of a reprieve. We only had 7 fatalities that occurred. But in 2024, so far, we already have 7 fatalities due to wrong-way drivers. And a lot of times these are multiple fatalities involved in these crashes.
One thing that does strike me in looking at this chart is that most, not all, but most of these wrong-way driver cases involve people who were driving while impaired.
Yes. So that's the major finding, a major issue that we're seeing. Even back to pre-COVID, the vast majority of these drivers, upwards of 90%, some years it's 100%, the driver has a BAC that's above 0.2. So they're almost 3 times the legal limit for blood alcohol content. And more recently, we're starting to see other drugs that are mixed into their system. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're impaired, simply because THC and some of these other drugs, they will stay in your system for days and days after you've used them. But we're starting to see kind of that polydrug use, where there's combination of drugs in people's system.
I'm also looking, Dr. Jackson, at the areas where these have happened. Are you noticing any trends as to the locations?
So a lot of these crashes are happening in your larger cities. Some of that is a factor of there's more opportunities for people to get on the ramp the wrong way. But what we're also looking at is proximity to bars or alcohol distributors. What we know that these occur between, you know, midnight and 4 a.m. most of the time. A lot of times that's when bars are closing or parties are ending and people are starting to drive home. So it's most likely that it's maybe establishments or entities that could be responsible for people going out and driving impaired.
And taking a look at the data, many of these wrong-way incidents have not had just one, but multiple fatalities as well, correct?
Absolutely. So there's a lot of times there's more than one person in the car, or people in both cars end up dying simply because it's a head-on crash on the interstate. Another interesting fact that we're starting to see a lot now is it's not only the wrong-way driver that's impaired, it's the driver that's coming in the correct direction. So you'll have two individual cars going opposite directions, and both drivers will have a BAC that's above the legal limit.
Are you guys comparing any of the data in Connecticut to data from other states? Because I did reach out to some of the other regional states here ahead of our conversation. Some of them had information for me, and some of them did not have information readily available. I was surprised to see that in Vermont, there were significantly fewer than what we're experiencing in Connecticut. For instance, in the last 6 years, they've only had 2 deadly wrong-way crashes, according to their DOT. Are you guys in talks with any of the other states to compare research?
So a lot of the programs that are being deployed in Connecticut actually started in Rhode Island. So the DOT's wrong-way driver alert systems that they're deploying out there actually were piloted in Texas first, and they saw a 30% decrease in the number of wrong-way driving incidents. Rhode Island deployed theirs in 2015, and they went from, I think, 13 fatalities in the previous 7 years to not having a single fatality. So there's a lot of coordination and talks that are going on with other states on how to deal with the wrong-way driving issue. We are talking to other states, and we have heard from other states that they're seeing an increase in wrong-way driving as well. A lot of that is because we're seeing an increase in impaired driving across the board. So there's a lot more impaired drivers that are out there on the roadway, and a lot of that can be attributed to during COVID, people started to turn to drugs and alcohol as a way of coping, and as they had a lot of free time, and when they were locked down, they started experimenting more.
Dr. Jackson is my guest this morning on Face Connecticut. Dr. Eric Jackson, Executive Director of the Connecticut Transportation Institute, located at the University of Connecticut. He compiles and analyzes a variety of crash-related data, and we're specifically talking about the wrong-way driving issue this morning. I'd like to point out information concerning drinking and driving and impaired driving. Do you have any data on that and how it's been looking as far as our crashes have gone in the last few years, not just wrong-way driving?
Sure. So every single fatality that occurs in the state, that fatal individual goes through an autopsy and a blood tox screen. Those reports come over to the Institute here at UConn and over to the Connecticut DOT as part of their data entry process. I will say anecdotally, once the COVID lockdown took place, the number of reports coming back through with people that had alcohol in their system or a combination of drug and alcohol increased dramatically. So 1 month, kind of a high-level generalization, 1 month we had 26 fatalities and crash reports come in, toxicology reports come in. Of those 26, 20 people that were involved in the fatal crashes had either drugs or alcohol in their system. So that's the vast majority. Connecticut has always been in the top five states in terms of impaired driving fatalities, where roughly 40% of our fatalities involve an impaired driver.
What information do you guys have concerning cannabis usage and how that might be impacting drivers? Any?
So we get the toxicology reports that come back from not only fatally injured individuals, but we're starting to compile tox reports that come back from the state forensics lab when they do when they pull people over and issue citations. One of the challenges with cannabis is there is no BAC level. So there's no threshold at which it's if you're, you know, if you smoked, that it's we can detect your level of impairment. And cannabis will stay in an individual system for up to 30 days, and it's fat soluble. So it'll be stored in your fat cells. So 10 days later, you'll go to the gym, you'll run, and all of a sudden THC will be released back out into your blood. It won't impair you, but it'll show up on a blood test. So we're seeing a lot more people now that it's recreational, a lot more people in the state have THC concentrations in their system, but we have no way of determining if that was an impairing level of THC because everybody's body is different and every concentration impacts individuals differently.
You know, I actually did not know that. You taught me something new, Dr. Jackson. Do you believe that at some point in time, maybe there will be some kind of a better test for that or no way of knowing?
So we're in the process of looking at saliva tests, or they have new tests out now that will actually look at your pupils and track your pupils to see how your pupils move as you look into kind of a virtual reality headset. So there's a lot of people out there a lot of companies out there trying to perfect a quantitative test to determine if you are impaired. The way that THC works is completely different than alcohol. So I don't know that we'll ever get to a legal limit for THC. So it's going to be down to these detection devices to truly determine physically if someone's physically impaired by the drug and not purely the presence in their system.
When you go to talk with the DOT about your research and findings concerning all crashes, not just wrong ways, are you part of their team that is trying to work out solutions for some of these problems based on data? So you're giving analysis. Are you part of any of that in any of those talks?
Yes. So we have a group at the Connecticut DOT, which is the DUI Task Force. We have a couple of our staff members and we have a couple of retired law enforcement officers that work here at the center. They're part of those task force. And we provide the Connecticut DOT with a lot of data. We recently hosted what was called a green lab where we had individuals come in. We hired a third party company that would work to dose them with cannabis. And then officers got the opportunity to put them through a field sobriety test so that they could physically see someone under the influence of cannabis, how they would actually put them through the field test and how their body responds under the influence.
Very interesting work. Dr. Jackson is my guest, executive director of the Connecticut Transportation Institute. I did want to ask another question because you were talking a little earlier about some of those wrong-way detection systems that have been installed in Connecticut, and that continues to this date. In fact, just this past week, I believe that they installed more of those systems at 5 locations in Connecticut, more to come. I did want to ask you, last I knew, there was a study going on at UConn concerning, I guess the term was reverse rumble strips for wrong-way drivers. So if you enter in the wrong direction, you'll hear a noise, whereas if you're driving in the correct direction, you won't. Are you aware of any of that?
Yeah, we're actually working with the Connecticut DOT to get that project underway. A couple of years ago, we did laboratory or computer models to look at if these rumble strips were effective. So we have a design developed. Our next step is to actually start physically developing these out in our testing facility and then start having cars drive over them to see if they perform the same way in the real world as they did in the computer simulation. So the goal would be that if you're driving the wrong way up the ramp, it would feel like you have a flat tire. It would basically alert you that you are driving the incorrect direction. But if you're driving the right way over these, there's very little to minimal vibration that's put back into the car.
Fascinating work for sure. Is there anything early on in this process that you're learning about these rubble strips and any, not necessarily challenges or work-throughs, but is there anything that you're learning as you guys develop those and look at the data of these wrong-way crashes?
So we're going to start physical casting and development this summer, so we haven't started the physical testing yet, but we're hopeful that they will provide some feedback. There are challenges that go with these in terms of, you know, making sure we don't create a spot where water can pool, because these are going to be recessed into the pavement and then turn into a large icy patch. So there's a lot of challenges we'd have to overcome, but the first step is, do they perform the same way in the real world as they do in the lab?
Is there anything else, Doctor, that I have not pointed out yet concerning the wrong-way crashes, particularly the fatal ones? And I'm sure you guys have been measuring the non-fatal ones as well.
So the Connecticut DOT's system appears to be starting to be effective. You know, obviously they don't have them at every single ramp at this point. I think the latest detection system that I saw actually caught a drunk driver. The lights went off. They tried to turn around and got stuck in the mud, and the law enforcement was able to arrest that individual. Another common request I get all the time is the ability to put spike strips out on the rumble strips or out on the off ramps. The last thing we want to do is disable a vehicle that has the opportunity to turn around and not cause a crash. So a lot of times those spike strip applications just don't work on an interstate or off-ramp system.
That's interesting you brought that up, because that's something that I've heard in my line of work, and I think that we had addressed that some time ago, that the DOT is frowning on that possibility for various safety reasons at the end of an exit ramp.
Correct, yeah. The last thing you want to do is disable a vehicle and have that individual get out of their car on an off-ramp as people are exiting the interstate. That's almost guaranteed to end up in a fatality for that individual when, if they didn't have their car disabled or tires disabled, they could have made a U-turn and exited the ramp without incident.
Is there any data to suggest the actual physical formation of the interchanges where, say, a local road meets a highway? Maybe you have a T-shape entrance and exit ramp system onto a highway. Is there anything to suggest that perhaps any of those might need reworked if those are areas where we're seeing more wrong-way driving crashes?
Obviously, some of our interchanges where you have the on and off ramp right next to each other, that always poses a potential for someone to make a wrong decision, whether it's a GPS that's telling them that to take the turn, or it's dark and not light enough and they can't see what's going on. What we're potentially going to be looking at as well is, if we convert those to a roundabout, does that increase safety in terms of with a roundabout, it's going to be extremely difficult to confuse the on and off ramp just by their individual design. So are we able to basically eliminate all of these opportunities if we change the physical design? Now, there's a lot of issues that go into that. That's a very expensive fix. It's a time-consuming fix. You have to shut down the ramp. You have to reconstruct. You have to have enough room to be able to do that. So that's kind of a long-term potential fix, but it is a very high-cost fix to be able to do that on the off-ramps.
Dr. Jackson, my guest this morning on Face Connecticut, executive director he is of the Connecticut Transportation Institute at the University of Connecticut. Dr. Jackson, people who are curious in learning more about the research that you are putting into this, your team, everything that you're working on, and the data that you've compiled on wrong-way crashes, again, like I mentioned earlier, you have some great charts and graphs that help to really visualize and summarize a lot of the points that we've been discussing this morning. Where can people find this, and where can people learn more?
Absolutely. So if you go to ctcrash.ucon.edu, that's our webpage where we host all of our crash data. There's a series of dashboards. So there's a dashboards and a story map. So if you click on that story map, you can basically look at some really amazing graphs and charts and trends that start off in 2015. So there's over 9 years worth of data in those dashboards alone.
Dr. Jackson, I'd really like to thank you for coming on Face Connecticut this morning. Is there any other thought that you'd like to leave our listeners with in our final moments?
Absolutely. The main thing is to slow down, pay attention. We're seeing an increase in aggressive driving out there on the roadways. So take your time getting to where you're going to go and arrive alive.
Thank you, Dr. Jackson, and we'll have to do another update at some point.
I'd be happy to.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Face Connecticut is a production of the News and Public Affairs Department of WTIC Radio.
How We Made Your Mother is a rewatch podcast that looks back episode by episode at the hit TV show How I Met Your Mother. It's hosted by me, Josh Radner, along with series co-creator Craig Thomas.
In seasons 1 and 2, we were joined by Neil Patrick Harris, Kobe Smulders, Bryan Cranston, Ashley Williams, Wayne Brady, Jenna Fisher and Angela Kinsey, Joe Manganiello, and my brilliant co-creator Carter Bays. And now we are diving into season 3.
So whether it's your 50th rewatch or your first time through, follow How We Made Your Mother wherever you get your podcasts.